it's Sunday night, then that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome. It's 148th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 147 shows may be found under www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com, and Westchester Guardian is WestchesterGuardian. It includes the 206 column, the Creative Disruption series, entitled "When You Come to the Fork in the Road." I hope you'll read the column, and if the spirit moves you, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. At my website, you'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, the environment, arts and entertainment, opinion and technology, with the real focus on artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, and what lies ahead. Try it and subscribe. It's free and only one email per day. And once again, you can find that link at www.johnmack13.com. I hope to join us every week at 7 p.m. on Eastern Time on Sunday nights, to live or as most to listen later. Next week's guest will be columnist and writer Virginia Heffernan, author of Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of the interview, but my guest. My guest tonight is Douglas Garb, the veteran of all fields writing, newspapers, magazines, books, reporting, editing, speech writing, etc. I first met Doug about 35 years ago when he, Barbara, and I were part of the group writing about the relatively new field of my computer technology. We used to meet once a month for lunch on 46th Street in Manhattan to schmooze and compare notes. The group's included the three of us, Esther Dyson and Steve Levy, both previous guests on this show, Steve Ditlia, Phil Elman DeWitt, Myron Bergel, Lindsay Van Gelden, and many others. We originally called the Lunch Group the Lunch Group, and our meetings led to the publication of a book that was way ahead of its time. We'll get to that later and to much more on tonight's John Mack Radio Show with Doug Garr. Good evening. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Thanks for having me, John. It's really a pleasure to be able to have a conversation with you tonight.
Okay. Let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
Well, I grew up in Mount Vernon, New York. I was born in the Bronx, but my family wanted a little piece of paradise when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And we moved to Mount Vernon, New York, a suburb which is probably known more for its ethnic enlightenment and six or seven star basketball players that went to the NBA. I graduated Mount Vernon High School in 67, which was kind of it was a great time. I mean, it was before a lot of turmoil about Vietnam, but the nice thing about it was we had 3,000 people in the school and 800 in my graduating class. So it was a very big school. It had integrated the entire city, and everybody. If you I look at my yearbook and I see everybody at the lunch table. We were ethnically integrated and we were enlightened, and there was never. I don't remember a single fight in the high school cafeteria.
The Williams brothers that I remember. both went to the NBA from Manhattan, and the fellow that I used to play basketball with taught one of them, the fellow named Ed Robbins, who was, and he moved up to Upper West just near me.
Yeah.
In addition to other high school activities, you were so proficient in wrestling that led to the college scholarship. Tell us about that.
Yeah, when I was I was kind of obsessed with wrestling in around eighth or ninth grade. My older brother, who was 5 years older, went to Lehigh University. And in the Eastern Conference, Lehigh was a legendary team, and he was the editor of the college newspaper and then later publisher, the Brown and White. And Lehigh wrestling was a religion, like in Iowa and Oklahoma State, and. He took me to a couple of meets at Grace Hall, and the place was packed. And I just said that, wow, this is so cool. And I was too little to really play well in any of the conventional sports. And I knew my high school had a really good team. And in ninth grade, I wrote a letter to the coach saying, I want to be on this team, and, you know, give me some advice. And I went out for the team, and I made the team, and we won the state championship in my junior and senior years, and I co-captained the senior year team. And years later, I became very close with my coach, obviously, and years later, he sent me that letter I sent to him in ninth grade. And it was a pleasure. And the nice thing about our team was, you know, there's 12 guys on the team. He never cut anybody. Because the team chose itself during the wrestle-offs. And he loved that aspect of it. And I looked at the team, and you look at the picture, it's so multifarious. There's black guys, Italian guys, Jewish guys, whatever. It was like really broken down, and we had a really great brotherhood. I finished second in the New York State Championships my senior year. I lost the last match. And I got a number of scholarship offers and an appointment to the Naval Academy, and I chose to go to Syracuse because it had a good Division I team, and I didn't know what I wanted to do in my life, and that seemed like a good way to go. So I got a full scholarship, and I was on my way out of the household.
Yet you were so obsessed with wrestling, and you did so well in it, you dropped out of it at Syracuse, and you gave up the scholarship. What led to that?
It was really fun. You know, it's an interesting question because at the end of my sophomore, I did pretty well. I was second the freshman Easterns. I made the varsity as a sophomore. But at the end of my sophomore year, you know, it was 1969. The country was going through this huge transformation. You know, the summer of 69, if you think about it, it was the Manson, Tate Lobianco. It was Woodstock. And man landed on the moon. You can't get a more interesting year when I was 20. And you know, my best friend from junior high, who I'm still friendly with, we did a road trip to California in the summer of 69. We got to California when the Tate household was being cordoned off with police tape. We were stunned, a man landed on the moon. It was like the best and worst of America. It was this cultural extravaganza of contradiction. So, and when I got back my junior year, and I just said, I can't do this anymore. I need a career. Because, you know, typically wrestlers become phys ed teachers, which is fine. It's a nice career. And coaches. And you go around the country looking for a job. And I said, I don't want to do this anymore. And luckily, I got hooked on in a very good journalism program at Syracuse at the Newhouse School, and I because I had absolutely no talent whatsoever to write a simple declarative sentence, I was lucky enough to get admitted and get a degree, and that was what did it.
But then, when you went, you also went from wrestling to something much more practical as a hobby. Like skydiving. How'd you get into that?
Yeah, that's interesting. In fact, I made 3 jumps today in New Jersey. I'm pushing 1,500 jumps, and it's interesting that happened. I was my sophomore year, my roommate in our dorm was a skydiving instructor, and he And when he found out I was a journalism student, he said, well, why don't you write an article about skydiving? And I said, well, it's interesting. You know, I'll think about this. And a couple of months went by, and he kept bugging me. And then he said, you know, if you really want to write about skydiving, you should try it. So one April in 69, he got me down to this small airport in central New York, Green in Chenango County. And he took me up for a skydive. And, you know, there's only one way to describe it. You know, I landed on the ground and I was rolling on the grass and I started laughing uncontrollably. It was, you know, dissipating the fear, but also the absolute joy. And the only way I can describe it to someone who has never done it is I said, it's probably like the crack addict that smoked one pipe and got addicted. You know, 2 weeks later, I bought a parachute that was used and I was on my way. And it just, it became an interesting hobby. It's very existential. The people in the sport are really interesting. I'm very active with the Hall of Fame and Skydiving Museum. I raise money for them every year. I'm considered one of the elder statesman guys, even though there are guys a lot older that are still doing it. When I first started, we used to look at guys in their 40s and say, oh, this is sick, you know, when this is not a sport for a 40-year-old. But now, and I'll cut this off right away, but the equipment and the techniques and the safety now is so much better that it's not uncommon at all to go to an airport where they have skydiving and see many jumpers in their 50s, 60s, and even 70s now. So it's really a lot of fun, and it's when I tell people it's stress reduction for me, they look at me weird, but then they sort of get it.
I go the monthly to the luncheon in Yonkers called the Narrowbacks, and the Narrowback was the second generation off the boat. The first guy off the boat was the broadback, who had to carry the stuff, do the heavy lifting, and
got it.
And then the next generation, and one of the people there. He's a very interesting guy in that he's a member of the Veterans Organization, and he goes around and he buries people who were abandoned, who were vets and this, but he also was airborne, and he jumped as part of a, when he was supposed to jump once into Yankee Stadium, and he also jumped into Van Cortlandt Park when he wasn't supposed to, and they didn't take kindly to that, but he didn't go away or anything. But it's just very interesting. And I normally think of airborne people, like the fellow that I was with in the fellow that was in the Army who were tall and trim and good looking and with wings. This guy's a little short, heavy guy, but he's a. But he's jumped a lot in his life, so
yeah. That's interesting. It will accommodate a lot of different physical, structures. It's nice to be in good shape and do it, but you know, I see people all the time out there that aren't, you know, typical physically excellent specimens, and they do it. Airborne is, you know, as you know, Army and the paratroopers, I have great respect for them. Not only were they the beginnings of the sport part of it, but it's an interesting story, but a couple of years ago, I saw a TV show honoring D-Day. It's typical. It comes up every June, right, June 6th. And they interviewed an older guy who was an American paratrooper, who lied about his age to get in the United States Army, and at 17 he was on the night jump that jumped into, that was supposed to jump into Normandy, and famously, if you've seen all the movies or read any of the books, they missed the target area, and he landed 5 or 6 miles inland, and he landed by himself, and he buried his chute and woke up in the morning, only to find one other American paratrooper that was not around, that missed the spot, and a platoon of 5 French soldiers, and the 7 of them went into battle together, and he described it so antiseptically, and I was almost in tears because I said, oh my God, jumping into Normandy at night with all that equipment, missing the spot. I said, do you know what kind of nervous, 17 years old, what kind of, you know, I can't fathom the courage that this man had, and a lot of these guys became skydivers, and You know, it's a different thing. Now, your friend that jumped into Central Park illegally, that we call that an outlaw jump or a bandit jump. And I have a professional rating, and I don't do that. I used to do that quite a lot because in the old days, the FAA and everybody kind of looked the other way as, it's a quaint stunt. And I know the guy who jumped into Shea Stadium very well. I know him very well, Mike Sergio, and the guy who jumped off the World Trade Center, Owen Quinn, very well. And they know each other very well. And that kind of thing goes on less and less now because we don't want to, you don't want to blemish the sport. So the trick is to try and follow the rules now. That's all I'll say about that.
One of the funny stories about that, before we go back to Syracuse, Bo Deedle, the well-known police detective, spoke to New York Amateur Computer Club once, and the friend of mine who was the computer crime cop, Don Delaney, had been working with him, and Deedle went off the police force because he was moonlighting, providing protection for a Middle Eastern, probably the Saudi, the prince, and the Saudi prince was going skydiving, so he went up in a plane with him, and he was staying there, and they started giving him a hard time. Oh, you're supposed to be such a brave guy, and you have a French connection and all this, and you don't do this. So he went, and he said everything went fine on the way down. They told me just what to do. It was perfect. They didn't tell me how to land, though. I broke both my ankles, and I went off the police then because of being injured, moonlight.
That's a funny story. That's great. Well, you know, a number of luminaries have jumped. Tiger Woods, Michael Schumacher, the multi-time German world champion before he was sustained a very serious injury, he jumped. George Bush Sr. has made 3 or 4 jumps, notoriously.
Right.
So,
Bush, Yeah.
It's not the danger it was when I was a little kid. I mean, there is risk. I'm not going to minimize it. But today, if you're safety conscious and you stay current and follow the training, we like the cliche we always throw out at you is the most dangerous part of the day is driving to and from the airport. So, we like to, kind of abide by that.
Were you active in school publications once you got into the journalism school?
Yeah. What happened was I made that first parachute jump, and I went to – and I had written 3 or 4 articles for the Daily Orange, which is our school daily. And I went to the sports editor, and I said, hey, I just jumped out of a plane. Can I write a piece about it? And it ran above the flag on the sports section a couple of days later. And, I just said, wow, this is just fantastic. And so that was one of the things I did. And my senior year in college, when I was well entrenched in thinking I'm going to try and make a living selling words or editing words, I had an advanced seminar in magazine writing, and I had a great teacher there, no longer with us, named Andre Fontaine, and he tried to teach the course as if you were a freelance writer. And he said, here's the deal, guys. Anybody who gets an A, anybody who sells a story in this semester gets an A. That's it. So I went out and sold a skydiving story to Popular Science magazine that semester about jumping the new rectangular chutes that were just barely coming onto the market then. So I wrote a first-person, what they call science adventure piece. I'll never forget this because I got paid $500 for it. And I thought, man, they're going to pay me to do this? I was like, I was ecstatic. And the piece ran in August of 71. And a month or two later, I had started a newspaper job in Westchester on a weekly. And the editor called me up and he said, we're running your story and I'd like you to come down and just chat. So I went down and I just chatted. And he said, we never know when we have openings here, but maybe I'll give you a call. And 2 months later, he called me up and said, come to work for me. And he gave me a $20 or $30 raise, which I thought was like incredible. And that started my career. They gave me an air travel card, and the only restrictions you had were your imagination. I got to travel. There's the old story, travel on the company dime. If you could come up with a good story in a foreign country, man, you were on your way. For one of the first stories I came up with was the electronic watch industry starting to infiltrate Switzerland. So I next thing I knew, I was the first person in my family on a plane to Zurich. And you know, I was one of the, I mean, what a job. My first job out of college. I'm an assistant editor, and they're sending me on my way. Yeah, I couldn't have planned it any better.
Was Popular Science owned by Ziff?
Not at the time. It was owned by Popular Science Publishing Company, and the only other publication they had at the time was Outdoor Life, which is,
okay.
You know, as you know, a sport, you know, an outdoor sports hunting and fishing enthusiast
right.
magazine. They had that for several years. They finally sold out 5 or 6 years later, but I only stayed 2 years. I was young and on my way and aggressive, and I really wanted to move on. And after 2 years, the stuff started to feel the same, and I really wanted to branch out a little bit. So, but what a great first job. I jumped with the Minnesota Pararescue Team in the middle of the winter at sub-zero temperature. We threw snowmobiles out to do a simulated rescue in the woods. I mean, I had a lot of fun with that job. Don't get me wrong. It really trained me as a journalist, and I also got to exercise my wanderlust.
I know that after Popular Science, you became involved with College Magazine. Was that the startup?
Yeah, it was a startup. It lasted about a year. We had a lot of ambition and a lot of great ideas and almost no money. And that was a shame, but we did some good stories. I had Nat Hentoff write about Lenny Bruce. We wanted to be like a Rolling Stone for the college set, and it just never took off. We were undercapitalized, underfinanced at the time, but I met some really good people, and we published a few good things.
I know that after that, you went back into newspaper work with the record. There was once the Bergen record. What led you to that?
Well, I had this investigative bent. I had done two or three front page stories for the Village Voice that made some noise. The doctors that were making money on methadone. I had done a story on nasty landlords that were trying to, you know, get people out of their apartments. And I did a piece on Valium that was about how Valium was the new drug of abuse. And the guy who was the editor at the record, you know, saw some of these stories. And one of my friends who worked there encouraged me to apply. And he said, look, instead of freelancing, you can do this and get paid for it every day. So I went out for an interview, and they hired me there. And I did a couple of years there. And I worked for a terrific editor who was the investigative news editor on a massive story investigation. And, you know, it was the era of Bernstein and Woodward, or post-Bernstein and Woodward, and I wanted to catch crooks, and so I did that. And, you know, the nice thing about my career is I've had my feet in a lot of different ponds.
The nice thing about crooks and corruption in New Jersey is it's always there, too.
We used to joke about that, yeah.
In addition to freelancing, after that, you returned to the magazine with Video Magazine as editor-in-chief. It's about the time we were working on the anthology that I mentioned, Digital Deli.
Yeah.
I remember that you almost couldn't be part of the book because you were working on another book with Mike Edelhart, one of my editors at PC, and you told me that you didn't think you'd be able to do it.
Yeah.
But you did.
Yeah.
How'd you ever work that out?
Well, I basically, you know, the funny thing was we got an advance from Addison Wesley, and we had a great idea for a book. And at the time, Mike, my partner, started working for Omni, and he got sidetracked. This was very interesting because then the book got delayed. And when it got delayed, Addison Wesley wasn't really, what's the word? They weren't ecstatic about delaying it because this was 83, 84, and everybody was saying, you know, we got to get these books to market very quickly. So I wrote I sent in a bunch of text, and then Mike sent in a bunch of text, and then we finally had it in the can. And then I said to Mike, and then Mike started recruiting me to write for Omni, which I did, which was a lot of fun. I did a bunch of pieces for them in the mid 80s. When it was a pretty hot magazine. And then at the time, you know, right at the same time, there was Digital Deli, as you know, and the Lunch Group. And it was kind of a free-for-all. As long as you weren't in a direct conflict of interest with somebody, you did it. And the job at Video came up, and I went for an interview. And, you know, I had done a couple of freelance pieces for the publisher of a group of magazines there, and he called me and he said, you know, we need somebody to run video. And I said, I don't know anything about home video. He says, yeah, but you're a computer maven. You're into technology. You could learn about video. So he talked me into taking the job in late 83, and I actually ran the magazine for 3 years. And at the same time, I published the first book on Steve Wozniak for which came out. It was meant to be a young adult book, but then they liked it so much they said, let's just publish a mass market paperback. And Avon Books published it, and they gave me a 2-book deal, but they never came through for the second title. So it was a lot of fun. The mid-80s were really big, and as you know, one of the most famous books of all technology came out at that time, which was The Soul of a New Machine by Tracy Kidder in 84.
Steve Levy's
book, Hackers, yeah.
Yes, the other thing was that that you mentioned, we had to get things out. That was my problem. We wrote what we think was the first book on microcomputer publications, but it was published by John Wiley. And
right.
John Wiley, in 83, they were used to turning things out slowly. We wrote it in 82 because their book was a Dan McCracken's COBOL book that could just go on and on and on.
Right.
And it took them over a year to get it out. And by the time it got out, Daniel Shapiro, who was with McGraw-Hill, who I knew from the Apple user group, he had started the book after me, got it out before me. Then one of the reviewers, Duvall Books, said, it's well written, but adds little to what Neil Shapiro has already said on the subject. And I felt like throwing it right out the window. On Digital Deli, in addition to our rather small group, we reached out to both tech people like Bill Gates, Dan Bricklin, Mitch Kapoor, and Nolan Bushnell, and to non-tech people to use computers like William F. Buckley Jr., the mystery writer John D. McDonald, Tenney Youngman, and the great Ray Bradbury. Do you remember some other names?
Well, Wozniak contributed, I remember. Woz did a piece. There were a bunch of other people. You know, I don't have it right in front of me, but I remember looking at the titles and thinking, like, God, this book was so ahead of its time. Steve Ditlia, you know, this was his touch of genius, and that he said, you know, to Workman, you know, to Peter Workman, you know, hey, this is happening. And Workman said, you know, I got to have a book on this stuff. And at the same time, I think that the Whole Earth software catalog was in the works. You know, it was, you know, that was going to be some sort of, you know, Venn diagram type competitor. But so many things were happening then. You know, the Hacker Conference in LA, in San Francisco, which I went to, all of these things were happening kind of like in the mid-80s. You know, the cauldron was really, you know, brewing at the time.
Well,
and it was
the promotion on Digital Deli was terrible, and we sold about 10 copies. We would have only sold 10 if Esther Dyson hadn't given copies out to multi-hundred mailing lists. However, the majority of the articles that are still relevant, they're available online at www.atariarchives.org/deli. That's atariarchives.org/deli. You also mentioned the book with Adelhard and the book with Wozniak, and you later had on the book that we'll come back to about Lou Gerstner's impact on IBM. So even as you moved into the areas, you still had tied somewhat to technology and computers for the rest of your career, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate description. I can't argue with that. The IBM book was certainly one of the most satisfying projects I ever did. And I didn't go work for IBM thinking I was going to do the book. You know, I wrote speeches for the number 2 or 3 guy there at the time.
You're way ahead of me.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to jump.
That's right.
But yeah, technology and business have dominated my my writing. Yeah, there's no two ways about it.
After you got tour with video and computer entertainment magazine, you moved back into newspapers as a columnist for Newsday. Tell us about that.
Well, I had left Video Magazine, and I still knew a lot about video from, you know, all the things that were going on in the industry. At the time, taping was going to the Supreme Court, the Sony decision. You know, do we have the right to tape stuff off the air? And I had a long Jack Wayman, who used to be working for Lyndon Johnson, was the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. He was the lobbyist. He was to the to Hollywood the way Wayne LaPierre is to the NRA, a big swinging you know what. So we got on the phone and debated this, and he said, you know what, video is going to kill Hollywood. You know, you guys can't have this stuff. I said, it's not a question of having it. It's a question of paying for it and having a secondary market. I said, Jack, look, look at all of these movies that are on the shelf that bomb. They have a secondary life if royalties are paid on video in all these foreign countries. He said, yeah, but a lot of it's being pirated. I said, yeah, but guess what? You can sell dual VCRs and most people aren't going to. You know how hard it is to go into the business and copy it? You know, it's like selling, it's like trying to sell joints on the street individually and becoming a marijuana magnate. It's just too hard to do. I said, there's room for everybody here. And I happen to be right about that. You know, I was the one that ended up being right. But they fought it for years, and video, later all the other media that has taken right through Netflix and net streaming, all of this stuff was a harbinger back in the days of the 80s. And my Newsday columns covered a lot of this stuff. Some of it was heavy technical, and other stuff was, you know, I took off after Cablevision on the New York Yankees and New York Rangers and the Islanders, you know, when they had these fights about whether we're going to have to pay for premium channels or get it in the package. I saw some of this early on. I wrote some controversial pieces that got a ton of mail. And, they went up to the top in editorial, like, do we want to run this piece? And I'm thinking, like, you better run this piece or I'm going to quit. You know, it's fact-checked. It's an opinion piece, but it's right. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. So I did that for about 2 years. I had a good time. It was in the Sunday TV section. It got some readership. It didn't get a lot of readership, but it certainly gave me a lot of fun and satisfaction.
Well, after 2 years there and three with Movies USA, you went into the big departure into speech writing. What took you in that direction?
Well, this was fun. One of my friends, this was in the early 90s, and one of my friends from high school, a very close friend of mine, became the chief of staff for Mario Cuomo. And years earlier, he had said, you know, do you ever want to go into politics? Because he said, you know, you seem to have a bent for it. And I said, nah, I don't want to be on that side. And in the early 90s, there was a speechwriting opening for Mario Cuomo in his last term as governor, which seemed to be interesting because the governor wanted to write a book about New York State. And his theme was, you know, by the way, when they hired me, I had to take a test where it was a bake-off and they did a blind taste test on speeches. And I kind of won that. But what happened was the governor wanted to write a book which, you know, was very ambitious in its political reach. He basically said everything great that happened in the federal government had its roots in New York State. You know, that the grand design of democracy was started in New York. And it was kind of an interesting idea, and that intrigued me. And when I was told that the parameters of the job were I didn't have to move to Albany, I could work out of an office in New York, and that part of the time I would be doing economic speeches for the governor in New York, and the other part of the time I would be working on this book. And I thought, what a great, you know, this is a great way to spend a couple of years. And And I said to the chief of staff, who was my friend when I got hired, I said, what happens when this book is published? He said, well, if the governor really likes you, he'll find something good fun for you to do. Or if not, you'll look for, you know, you'll move on. He said, you know, either way, you know, things should work out if it does. I ended up having a great 2 years with him, and the book got published. It was called The New York Idea, An Experiment in Democracy. Crown published it. We got paid all the monies and royalties that came in went back to the taxpayers. It was scrutinized by the New York Times. They wrote an article about it. And what the enjoyable part about that was I developed a relationship with Mario Cuomo that extended far beyond him losing his attempt at a fourth term. And, you know, it revolved around words and publishing and whatnot. I was helping him with his speech book. I was a midwife on that. I directed that to a friend of mine at St. Martin's Press who really wanted the book, and the governor got other offers that were bigger, and I kind of said, you know, St. Martin's will really do this right. So that's how that happened. I never thought I'd write speeches. In fact, one of my funniest anecdotes was I was up in the governor's mansion talking to actually on the second floor, and we were talking one day, and the governor asked me, you know, during a lull, he said, what was your experience as a speechwriter? I said, well, in eighth grade, I took third place in the Optimist Oratorical contest. And he looked at me, and he looked at me kind of strange. And I said, well, Governor, there are only four people in the contest. And I still feel bad for the poor guy that took fourth that day. And he just cracked up, you know. So that's it, you know, and that was it. I just felt I could write orally for somebody I really liked and believed in his politics.
Two things come to mind about him. Barbara and I were driving home from dropping the kids off at the birthday party in Riverdale, and we're coming up the sawmill. We're just getting on to the Conic, and I turned on one of these Westchester radio stations, probably VOX. You can only get for about 100 feet, you know.
Right.
And I heard him giving the graduation speech to Iona, where his daughter was graduating from. And the speech was so good, we pulled off the road to listen to it.
Wow.
He was directing it to the parents. It's the parents' day for what they've given up, you know, and all this. And you're starting your life. You brought them to where they want to be right now, you know, and just a terrific speech. The other interesting thing about him is the fellow was the close friend of his, who started off, and he probably still is, as the Rockefeller Republican, Bill O'Shaughnessy.
And he got
to know him so well interviewing him. He thinks more of him than anyone ever in the world. He has a new book about their letters back and forth, and I want to get him on the radio show.
Yeah,
too.
Bill would be great. I was on his radio show when Rich Garfunkel had that one in Westchester. I was on that several times as well. And O'Shaughnessy was a great admirer of Mario Cuomo. And it's funny, when I was invited to the funeral, you know, the first invitation-only funeral I ever went to a year ago, January, and I happened to I was online with Dan Quarris, the public relations guy who's now into making movies, and I sat next to Ken Auletta, who the writer for The New Yorker, who's written a lot about business and technology, and Ken and
Google.
I just sat there reminiscing about the Gov.
The only person who I ever knew who did not say good things about him was Al Del Bello, because he was lieutenant governor, and apparently he ran really with Koch, and Carl McCall ran with Mario.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they were the two winners. Number one, they were two Italians who they never would have wanted on the ticket together. And according to him, Mario never forgot that he was on the other team. And according to him, he said he had known many people in politics, and Mario was the only one that he never put it back together again with. Finally, he resigned, as you may remember. He's no longer with us either.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, politicians carry grudges for a very long time.
Oh yeah.
And I've heard this sort of thing before, not that particular anecdote, but sort of things like that before. It's not uncommon, and you know, they hate to be slighted. Loyalty is the most important currency in politics, as you know. And you know, yeah, I've worked for a company. I've worked for a Fortune 500 company. I've worked for the journalism side, and I've worked in government. And what I try to tell young people that want to write for a living, I said, it is really an advantage to have dipped into each one of these areas for no other reason than you find out how they function, what the structure is like. And that really helped me a lot in my career. Stuff I never thought I would do. I said, wow, those years were invaluable because I learned X, Y, and Z, which I never would have learned in just one venue.
After you work with the governor, you've been back into the magazine business as an editorial consultant, this time with Ziff, Evolution Magazine, and Frequent Flyer. What did that work involve?
Well, I was more of a consulting editor. You know, I was trying to guide them to find a brand that people could relate to. You know, it was kind of fun. And at that point, I was mostly making my living freelancing. And when somebody called me up and said, we want to pick your brain, I would say, why not? Let's go to lunch. And then I would get hired. So that's how that happened.
You also did some work in that period for one of Barbara's alma mater's, NYU Graduate School of Public Service. What was that all about?
Well, I had made a connection there through Mitchell Moss, who was the director of the School for Urban Policy there, and he was a close associate, but he really admired the Cuomo administration. So that came out of working for Mario Cuomo. The nice thing about it is the networking from that led to a lot of jobs in the business sector. They'd say, well, you wrote for Mario Cuomo, you must know how to write. I would say, with all humility and in all honesty, I said he made me look a lot better than I made him look. And most speechwriters felt the same way.
Then it was into the corporate world with IBM as the speechwriter. I know that the position actually involved much more than only speechwriting. What was the work like, and were you at corporate headquarters?
No, I was in the in Somers, and they were after me for that job for several months. Bob Stevenson, who was the head of the Personal Systems Group, needed a speechwriter. Because what typically happens is the corporate people don't want to do it, so they say, hire a speechwriter. So I went up there a couple of times, and I finally realized they wanted me more than I wanted the job, so I tried to outline the job. I basically said, look, give me a ThinkPad. I'll work out of my house. I'm out of my apartment. I'll come up to Somers when you need me, because it's a 50-mile, hour-long drive, even though it's a reverse commute, and I'll do it like that. And, you know, I made all these demands, including a salary and bonus, and they said, okay. And I went to work for them. You know, I was on the job one day, and I was on one of the IBM jets off to Phoenix to do a speech with Bob Stevenson. And I found him to be a lovely guy who really needed, you know, he used to complain. He'd say, like, well, this must be a real, this must be a real demotion, having worked for Mario Cuomo. And I looked at him, and I said, Bob, I said, you know, give me, I said, what, are you kidding me? I said, I said, Mario Cuomo didn't need me. You need me. He got a big laugh out of that. And we had a great time. I did that for a couple of years. And then I decided that, I was going to write a book about it. Actually, I encouraged Gerstner to write the book before I left. I said they should just do a corporate sanctioned book. And I don't know, that memo never got on anybody's desk, despite the fact that I had some juice. At least that's what they told me. And what happened after that was in December of 97, I decided to leave and write a book. And I got an advance, a substantial advance, six figures right away, because Gerstner was really a hot topic. And it took me 2 years to write the book. And, I thought it was very successful. It got widely reviewed and translated into four or five languages. So I was very happy about that project. And I thought it was an honest book. It was about Lou Gerstner's personality and the company hiring outside its usual line of succession. And it was all about the pluses and minuses. And, you know, I predicted who Gerstner's successor would be, who had 10 great years, Sam Palmisano. And now they're at another crossroads. But that's another story and another question for you to ask at some point. But I had a lot of fun on that job, and I really felt like I contributed. I got to go to all the shows. I traveled internationally on IBM jets. Not on IBM jets internationally, but I traveled on all the IBM jets all domestically. And he gave speeches in every place from Stuttgart to Tokyo to Rio. So I was always on the road. We never stayed anywhere long, but again, this was another place to get my passport ticket punched, and I had fun doing that.
Were you there when Gerstner came in, or did he predate you with IBM?
Gerstner was there. He predated me. He was at the end of his first contract. So I got there in 96,
okay.
And he had been there for 3 years, and at that point, they had gotten the boat to stay afloat.
In the meantime, after you left IBM and you're working on the book, you're doing freelance speech writing and consulting, and you even did some ghost blogging. Tell us about that work and blogging in particular under someone else's name.
Well, this is interesting. It's very interesting, and it's a good question. When I first got called to Ghost Blog, I forgot how somebody got my name and called me up, but I looked at them and I said, you know, blogging was just starting out. And it was controversial because, you know, people said, well, you know, what is blogging? Well, blogging is becoming your own magazine, publisher, editor, writer, and, you know, PR person. So I forgot. This could have been I actually did some for some big corporations, but this was a small startup. And the guy sent me his stuff, and I called him up, and I said, look, with all due respect, I'm, you know, the whole idea of a blog is to assume the voice of you writing a letter to a friend, like the old New Yorker used to do in Notes and Comment. And you're a very smart guy, and he goes, well, don't these things need work? And I said, you know, a comma here, and, you know, I mean, a little light editing and minor editing, but it's your voice, and they're pretty well written. He said, are you talking yourself out of a job? And I said, I'm telling you, a blog, you don't need a, I've never ghost blogged, and you don't need somebody to ghost write a blog unless you're totally inept and you're a CEO of a corporation. You know, you can't get there without being able to write a sentence. So we had this kind of like dialogue on the phone, and he said, just try it, you know, and see what happens. So he would give me an idea, and I would write a draft, or he'd send me a draft, and I'd rewrite the draft. And some of the times I rewrote the draft, they weren't as good as his drafts. But that got me started, and I ended up doing stuff for like a big company in Mumbai, Infosys, and they had certain executives that needed ghost blogging, and certain executives that didn't. And I tried to delineate them and set up the structure of their company as they were trying to make inroads in the United States. I wasn't successful. I did that I had 3 6-month contracts that lasted a year and a half, and I was only semi-successful with that. But it comes back to my original idea, John. If you're smart and you know how to write a sentence and you can make an argument with logic, and you've got a college degree probably, or even if you don't, you can write a blog. It's not rocket science. And now a lot of them out there are terrible and they're histrionic and they're not good at all. But that, you know, the whole point of the internet is it's opened up opinion to everybody. And what are blogs but personal opinions?
Yeah, absolutely. And then in 2009, you published two books, your memoir about skydiving between heaven and hell and the adventure in freefall and stuff, an insider's look at who's really making America fat, co-authored with Henry Cardello. Tell us about these books. So did the skydiving one first?
Well, the skydiving book was a labor of love. I had written in 2001 during a lull. Actually, I'd started it a couple of years earlier, and I had completed it in 2001, right at the time of 9/11. And I couldn't find a publisher. And my agent said, it's too small a book. I can't sell it. You know, agents only want to work on 15% of a number they can go home with at night. And she said, this is going to be a very, you know, when they say it's going to be a tough sell, it means they don't want to handle it. So it kind of languished, and I went to Florida and wrote what I thought was the last chapter, hanging out with a bunch of guys that used to skydive, some luminaries, some not, that were getting together for an old-timers reunion. And I came back and I wrote the last chapter, and then I published, a few years later, I published a couple of them online on a website, a literary website, and the publisher called me and said, you know, this could be a book. You know, I said, well, it is a book. And he goes, oh, okay. Let me see the manuscript. I sent him the manuscript. He said, this is great, but it needs an ending. I said, what's the ending? He said, you should go back up there and jump for, you know, old time's sake. You know, and I said, well, I got to get my license current. I got to go into training again. It's like a pilot that hasn't flown in 25 years. So, but I really wanted to publish the book. So I went out there and I did it. This was in 2008 in May. And I got the book ready for publication in 2009, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, we had a nice publishing party, and it didn't sell particularly well because I knew that, but it got some nice publicity, and a lot of jumpers came, read it, and said, man, if Doug can come back, I can come back. And it was a lot of fun, and it was, but it was all more about coming of age and using skydiving as the backdrop. And, you know,
and
what do
why,
you want to be when you grow up, when you're 20?
And why is it not available on a Kindle? I tried to download it.
You know, we've been trying to get it ready for the Kindle, and I've had enormous problems with talking with the publisher about getting it on the Kindle. I wrote an actual epilogue or last chapter to try and update it, and we've had a lot of problems, you know, with the rights for, you know, the guy who redesigned the book didn't want to send it on, and it's kind of it's in a legal mess right now, but it's still available in print on Amazon.com. But I'm hoping to get the on Amazon.com. But I'm hoping to get the Kindle version out, hopefully sometime this year or early next year.
Then what about Stuffed?
Stuffed was fun. I got Stuffed came through a PR agent where I had done a tech story, and he said, I want you to meet this guy. And I said, who is he? He said, he's a business guy who in the food and beverage area that has a crisis of conscience. So we went out to lunch, and he said, I want to write a book. And I said, what about? He said, about how America's getting fat and what we can do about it. You know, it's about nutrition from a business point of view. And I looked at him, and I said, what are you, nuts? And he said, no, I really want to do this book. I said, why do you want to do this book? He said, I want my kids to you know, say that dad was, you know, sold sugar water to poor children, you know, in East Harlem and in Africa. I said, you really believe that? And he goes, yeah. I went, I'm in. So we had a two-year collaboration that was absolutely satisfying on both ends of it. And he enjoyed having me argue with him in certain chapters about points of view. And he sent me to bodegas, and he sent me to the Chicago Food Show, and he sent me all around, and we argued over language in a very positive way. It was one of the most satisfying collaborations I've ever had. And we came out with a really nice book that got very well reviewed. And, you know, and we did a lecture tour on it as well. And it was, I was flattered because even though I was only the co-author, I was called on to say, what do you think about this? And whatnot, and we went to. I got to meet the top people in the nutrition and diet field, and it was great. It was a lot of fun, and the book was very, very well received. A number of books have come out since, and I think this book stands up well on those shelves.
Terrific. Speaking of your books, in your writing career, you also co-authored The Mr. Mint's Guide to Investing in Baseball Cards and Collectibles with Alan Rosen. That's
right.
The kind of book that makes any one of the sick who no longer has his or her cards from the 40s, 50s, and the 60s. Are you one of those kids? And how did you get into it?
I grew up when the Yankees dominated baseball in the 50s, and the biggest argument in New York, as you know, is who was the best center fielder in town, Snyder, Mays, or Mantle. And that was one of the golden ages of baseball, where these guys weren't paid so much. You know, these guys all in the winter, they all went to work in bowling alleys and shoe stores and clothing stores. It was different. And baseball cards were what got us through elementary school. And, you know, if you had two Scourins, you know, you weren't going to let two Scourins go unless you got a, you know, a McCovey. Stuff was crazy, but it was a lot of fun. We put them in the spokes in the cars, and we didn't think twice about it. They went into shoe boxes, went into the attic, and sooner or later, Mom threw them away. And that started a business,
yeah.
A collectibles hobby and a business.
Then how'd you get into the book then?
I had a friend who was a PR guy, and he was a Syracuse alum with me. And he called me one day, and he had seen my stuff, and he said, I'm throwing a big press conference, and this guy has a Hannes Wagner card that he's going to, you know, sell for like zillions of dollars, whatever it was at the time, and come to the press conference. I go to the press conference. I wrote a piece about it for Forbes, and when the Forbes piece came out, you know, I thought, maybe there's something bigger here. So I called the guy up after the press conference. He invited me out to New Jersey, and I got there about like 8 o'clock at night. It was a big rainstorm. I get there about 8 or 9 o'clock at night. He starts showing me Eddie Collins's bat, and oh God, I forgot Ed Delahanty's spikes, and this and that. And I'm like going back to eighth grade, you know, or sixth grade. I'm going like, wow. And he's got Mickey Mantle rookie cards that were going at the time for $50,000. And I stayed there till like 3 a.m. And I just was entranced. And I said, you want to do a book? He goes, oh, you know, like, what do you mean? And I explained to him that, you know, this could be a book. And he said, yeah. So I spent several months with him on the road, going to shows. I bought 7,000 baseball cards to try and imitate what it would like to be a collector. And I started collecting single-signed Hall of Fame baseballs, which I have here in my office on the wall. And whenever somebody comes in, they go, wow, that is so cool. Hank Aaron, DiMaggio, Mantle, McCovey, wow, Bill Dickey, you know, Sandy Koufax, Yogi Berra, Phil Rizzuto. Wow. And I go, yeah, it's pretty cool. So my son has his eye on him. And I'll probably get them someday. You know, it was a lot of fun doing that. One of my two favorite ball. Everybody says, "What were your two favorite baseballs?" I say Cal Ripken because he signed it in front of me when he won his first Gold Glove at the New York Baseball Writers Dinner or the whatever dinner it was. I forgot. And the other one was Whitey Ford. And they say, "Oh wow, Whitey Ford." I go, "Yeah." Well, my mother sent it to me when the book was because when I was in eighth grade, Whitey Ford was the guest at Father and Son Night. And he signed a ball for everyone that was there. And I didn't even remember this at all. And my mother kept the ball. And when the book was coming out, she sent me the ball. So, you know what? It's more about sentiment than money. That's all I can say, John.
Not only do I understand that, I have autographed books from when I was very young. And I used to write to people like George Halas, the owner of the Chicago Bears, and all these people, and they wrote handwritten letters back. Joe McCarthy, who managed the Yankees and the Red Sox, sent me a Christmas card the year after I sent him the card. I have scrapbooks full of those. I also have in my bedroom a portion of the goalpost from the Colts Giant game in '58 when I was on the field at the end of the game. And I had been in the bleachers, and for the overtime, I jumped down on the field, and I was along the sidelines, and all the cop did was just move back a little. They would have shot me now, you know. And then after the game, we wound up fighting some Colts fans, and then walking out to part of the goalpost. It's a wooden goalpost.
How did the goalpost come apart?
It was wooden then.
Oh, okay.
So, and it's in pieces, and we wound up fighting back and forth, and finally breaking it over my knees till we could take it. You know, so it's.
I'm salivating. That was probably the greatest football game ever played up until some recent Super Bowls.
Absolutely.
I mean, that was like unbelievable. 23-17,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Oh,
Alan Ameche went across, and supposedly the rumor was why they didn't take the field goal because it was the sudden death rules then. You just had to score. People said that Carol Rosenblum, the owner of the Colts, wanted to cover the spread. They're not how true that is or not, you know. But
wow, it's a great rumor, you know, and it's probably worth a book and a movie.
And then, once again, you went back into the corporate world with Con Ed, and you're at the highest level of that organization for 4 years. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I wrote for the CEO. That came through the Cuomo operatives, too. The CEO needed a speechwriter to do outside speechwriting. And, and so Kevin Burke, a lovely guy, wrote for him for 5 years before he took early retirement, right after Hurricane Sandy. And I can imagine, a really bright guy, an engineer with a lot of degrees, and his father was a fireman. He grew up in the Con Ed organization. Brilliant guy, and who was a pilot, by the way. And all he wanted to do was retire to Florida and spend some time in his Florida place with his grandchildren. So he's a little younger than me, and he retired early. And but I had a good time writing for him because he was into language and whatever. The problem with writing for the CEO of Con Ed, though, is that you're never really necessary unless it's crisis management. And crisis management means, you know, he used to tell me, he said, when you flip the light switch and the lights don't go on, he said, that's crisis management. And, and I was trying to always get him out front as, it was the beginning of Obama and the national energy grid. So I was trying to do, you know, stump speeches and position papers and things like that. Again, that was fun and a diversion. But, you start thinking like, well, after you wrote for Mario Cuomo, there's not going to be a lot of luminary speeches you're going to do. So, I did that, and that was fun, until he retired.
Yeah, and you've been freelancing since then. Tell us, with all your diverse work in the general field of communication, writing in your own words, writing for others, consulting to others, do you have any real favorite work in the field?
Oh, God. Right now I write for the Association Magazine for the United States Parachute Association, which is a lot of fun. I get to it doesn't pay a lot. It's a labor of love. I'm editing projects through the New York Writers Workshop, which I'm a member of, which is, it's kind of a consortium of poets, essayists, writers, and playwrights. And we do a lot of teaching, and I enjoy doing lectures at the library. And I'm trying to inspire other writers at this point. I'm getting up there, and I still think I have one more good book in me. I don't know what it is yet. But on the other hand, a lot of it is trying to, leave your philosophy for others to kind of like pick up on, what's important in the printed or digital world right now. And as you know, from the beginnings of our careers to now, communication has gone through, massive disruption. And, it's very, an anecdote comes to mind. When my son was in school at Ethical Culture, he was at middle level school, I forgot what they called it there, but I went to the library one morning, and the two elderly women that were the librarians were teaching the kids about research on the internet, and they were out there saying like, well, how do we know all this is true? And I thought, oh good, they get this. They get this. They were putting, two librarians way older than me are putting the aura of skepticism into these impressionable 12 and 13 year olds and saying like, everything you see online isn't necessarily real or factual. Here's what you got to start doing. And, that was like, Internet 101. And it's gone on to lots of stuff, and it's different now, because we have, everybody is an author.
The title of my column that was weekly, now is bi-weekly, for the Western Guardian, is Creative Disruption. And it's not only in our business, it's all of everything that's being replaced by algorithms and artificial intelligence and machine learning, which can take us back to IBM, and all of these other things, which are such a disruptive force that are good for a lot of people and they're bad for more people. And we're having no public discussion about this. We're having no planning. We're having, I mean, our dysfunctional government can't even plan 2 months out in front, and there are such changes to our whole way of life that are imminent, and nobody seems to care.
Yeah,
it's very scary.
It is scary, and it goes back to, you know, there's two issues going on. One is security and privacy, and the other one is knowledge and the greater, you know, common good and moving information and forward. The first thing, the Soul of a New Machine, I remember hearing an interview with Tom West, who was the hero of the book, right? He worked for Data General. He was the guy that said, I'm going to hire the kids to do this programming real, real fast so we can compete with Digital Equipment Corporation. And the interesting, he had a great line, and he said, well, you know, somebody said to him, like, well, what do you think about all this technology and faster computers and mini computers at the time and whatever? And he said, I think it's great, except I have one, I'm really nervous about one thing. And the guy said, what's that? And he said, I'm really concerned that the kids growing up today won't know how many cans of beer there are in a six-pack. And it was not meant to be that glib, I don't think, but you could get the gist. You know, we can replace the slide rule with computation, and we can have computers that can play chess and do Jeopardy faster than any human mind that we have right now. But is this real intelligence? Is it real problem solving? Or is it just a tree search on an algorithm or some such thing? And that's one thing that has always struck me whenever I see a new piece of technology. The second thing is security and privacy. In 1997 or 8, I think I interviewed Esther Dyson. And when I finally got down, she said, what else do you want to talk about? And I said, security and privacy. And she said, oh, well, they're completely two completely different things. Now, in the context of that year, maybe she was right, but I don't think that Esther would answer that question the same way today, because they're totally related. And I don't even have to go into, you know, drill that down. I mean, you know, we all know that. And the third thing that is my biggest concern is data mining, analytics, you know, big data, the cloud. I have a certain skepticism about the tech industry that decides that every few years they have to rebrand things that are not maybe big technological advances. I mean, the cloud is great, right? But what is it but a server farm away from where you keep your information? It's another storage facility that's a backup. There's nothing magical about the cloud, but, you know, we're still in the infancy of technology, right? Here's the analogy I always give. Where do you think computers are in relationship to the automobile at the turn of the 20th century? I said, think about your own computer right now. Think about it. Would you buy a car that when you turn the ignition right now took a minute and a half to 2 minutes to start, and then after you drove 30 miles, it decided to stop, and you'd have to pull off the side of the road and restart it? All right? Or all of a sudden, you were cruising in the left lane at 65 miles an hour in a 65-mile-hour zone, and with no traffic whatsoever, all of a sudden your car, because it was autonomous driving, slowed down to 45 for no reason whatsoever. And then it speeded up. And then you learned that the hub was getting overloaded and there wasn't enough bandwidth to go to all of the autonomous driving cars. There are a lot of challenges out there, and it's not just some guy getting killed in a Tesla who's not paying attention. It's a bigger, broader thing, and I don't think we're having we're not having the dialogue that addresses these issues. That's my big complaint.
But the other side of that, I've been in the business since I worked on mainframes, is that there is more power in my smartphone than in a floor-sized computer that I used to work on from IBM. And more power than the computers that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. So the power's there. We're the ones who are limited by it, not the technology.
Yeah, I agree.
And we have to figure out both the social impact and the human impact, and also the technology of both security, public privacy. You mentioned.
I think that, you know, it's like one step forward, one step back when it comes to the debate. Because, you know, when I was a popular science, I learned one thing. If I asked an engineer, how long would this take to be come to fruition? You know, the engineer, he'd say, well, I think it can be done in 5 years. And it would inevitably get done. It would take longer or shorter, depending on how the marketing department was hyping it and how often and how long they needed it. If you asked a scientist working on pure research how long it would take, they'd say, oh, well, this is 15 to 20 years out. And then when you realize that there was all this competition in laboratories around the world, that 15 to 20 years would maybe take 12. So there's no doubt we're going to have driverless cars. And will they be flawed and will people get killed? You bet. But the 35,000 people a year that get killed will go down at some point in the next 30 or 40 years to 5,000. That's going to be far more acceptable. They're going to say, oh, my God, what did people do back in the 2000s? So you're right. All of this stuff is really great. It's a but it's not a question of brute force computing anymore and power. It's great to have a cell phone that, you know, has more power than took man to the moon. But on the other hand, you know, my Fidelity app right now crashes every time I call Fidelity, and they said, you have to go through Safari or Chrome or Google because we're having trouble with this app. Oh, okay, it worked great for a few years, but, you know, it's like, you know, how much do you improve a product to a point where you're losing your value add? You know what the perfect example is? Microsoft Word. Microsoft Word was born brilliantly, and then it didn't translate to a lot of different platforms. As you know, I can cite chapter and verse. And they, you know, and I finally said, why, if the product is 92% efficient, why risk screwing it up to make it 94% efficient? Most people aren't using all of the features on it anyway. Professional writers I know are not using all of this stuff. Oh, yeah, it's great to have a resume. It's great to have this template for this, that, and the other thing. But what good does it do if I'm going from one file to another and it can't even match the font? It took years for them to do stuff like that, simple things. I was an early adopter of Quicken, right? I'm going on a rant here for a reason. When the year 2000 came, it dumped all of my info. All of my info. I had to re-input everything. I wrote a nasty letter to Scott Cook, and I said, what's going on here? They sent me a new copy. You know, and by the way, they did it again. You know, years later, they did it again. Everything in my address book, you know, disappeared. All of the automated check writing I had disappeared. Now, we've gone further than that because you can say, well, Doug, you can have automated payments on almost all of your monthly bills. And I said, yeah. I said, but I'm just talking about interim increases here now. Every time you do something, Mr. and Mrs. America says, oh, man, I'm confused. I don't get this. You know, I used to have AOL, then I went to Yahoo, now I'm on Gmail, and now this thing is messing up. Every time you have a glitch, it makes Mr. and Mrs. America more doubtful about the increase in the efficiency of technology. And I think we're being overall a little too cavalier about this. That's just my two cents.
Two comments. Number one, and I've written about this off and on, mentioned column. The first working electronic computer, the ENIAC,
right,
was developed to be used in World War II. However, it was finished at a great cost overrun after World War II ended. So
yep,
it set the whole background for things always being late, that always costing too much.
Yeah.
Also, Jay Presper Eckert, who you remember, wrote the piece in Digital Deli.
By the way, I interviewed Press Eckert for the Complete Computer Compendium book.
and he used to be Steve Levy's landlord in Philadelphia.
Right. Exactly.
But he wrote this article, and he said he was one of these people who really didn't think like Vannevar Bob Bush did long range. He said, "I don't have a personal computer. I don't need one." But
he told me the same thing.
But if I did, I could. Then I said, then how'd you write this goddamn article? You know, it's supposed to be in the in the 20th century, anyhow, you know.
Yeah, well, what's his, you know, Bill Gates famously said we're never going to need more than, what, 264K meg or 264, whatever
five,
it was, you know. Everybody
five,
has shot themselves in the foot.
Five,
except
12,
for.
But he denies that.
Yeah, well, everybody, well, yeah, that's a, okay, maybe it's a matter of legend, but the only thing that's really held up is Gordon Moore's Moore's Law. But, you know, I you know, all of this is very quaint, you know. I mean, listen, if it weren't for World War II, ENIAC wouldn't have even been commissioned.
Yep.
It was used, it was invented because we needed to get artillery trajectories quickly in Northern Africa, in the war in Northern Africa. And I had a long talk with Press Eckert about this. And, you know, he told me, you know, not with in any uncertain terms. I said, what computer do you work on? And he said, oh, I don't need a personal computer. I think they're useless. He was thinking in a different sphere. It was all about macro there. And they had 70,000 vacuum tubes. And if some of them crapped out, they had a problem.
But in answer to your question about the changes and the new versions, software never wears out. So you've got people at Microsoft are up all night trying to think of new features that they can that they put into Microsoft Word that they can make people buy the new version. I mean,
yeah, but let me give you the other analogy again, right? What if you have a car? You have a Honda Accord, and you've had it for 7 or 8 years. And you finally go in and you say, oh, it's really – my muffler has a hole in it. And the guy says, well, John, I'm your mechanic, and I'll be honest with you. You know, Honda doesn't make make this muffler anymore. You got to buy a new car. You'd be furious.
Yes.
There's a law that says you have to keep parts for an automobile for 20 years. There's no such thing that has anything to do with technology. I go into Apple and I say, well, you know, my iPad's doing this, that, and the other thing. When did you buy this? 5 years ago. Oh, well, we don't support this thing anymore. Or the software, you know, this software won't run on it. You need to have an upgrade. How many times have frustrated consumers heard this? There's a point where you just say, I don't want to buy a new thing every 3 or 5 years. I like the thing that I have now. It works. I'm used to it. I love it. And I find this part of the industry somewhat distasteful. It's going on less now, but it used to be, and it used to be more ubiquitous earlier on. But we were so enthralled with the upgrade that we never really complained much because we were writing about it. We felt privileged. We felt, you know, we're in the club. The rest of the world is maybe not in the club. You know, I did a piece on Murray Turoff where I was one of the first people after Steve's wife, Teresa Carpenter, did it for The Voice. I think I did it for Omni Magazine on interviewing somebody online, you know, back and forth on email before anybody even really had an email account except academics. And I thought, this is pretty cool. This saves a lot of time. Asynchronous communication has... Think about it. Asynchronous communication filled in the gap between a letter or handwritten letter and the telephone in a way that nobody could have imagined. Billions of emails out there. And is this a good thing? Absolutely. You know. But my point is, for every good thing, there's always little stuff we have to suffer through.
Well, how long did it take the world to let me take my same Word file from my Mac to my Windows machine to whatever, you know, that went on forever too. And you had to have
you
these
make
programs.
My, you're making my point.
Yeah. And they eventually got to that, you know, so.
Yeah. No, you're making my point. And I'm really glad we're into the granular part of a tech conversation because, as you say, all of this stuff has its good side and it has its negative effects. But the more I look at it, I'm saying, like, our tolerance for things not working in technology is far greater than it is for other pieces of technology that have been around longer. And I want to say one other thing, too. I think too many the series of companies that have come up that make their living on what I call aggregation, you know, kind of gets me, you know, rubbing the wrong way. You know, I met the guy who started Kayak, Paul English. You know, this is an aggregator, a guy who came up with some software that basically said, you know, we'll get a piece of everybody that needs to buy X, Y, and Z. I'll tell you an anecdote that really is very interesting. 2 years ago, the summer before last or last summer, I forgot which, my wife and I were going to stay for a weekend on Martha's Vineyard, and we found a nice boutique hotel. And one of my friends had stayed there before, another writer, in the non-high season. And he told me it's very inexpensive, it's lovely, it's got everything, blah, 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 blah. You'll love this place. So I went online to say, here's the weekend I want, right? And this is the days I want. And the amount of money, the room rental was like triple what he paid. And I expected it to be higher, but not triple. I said, wow, that's interesting. I called him up, and he said, well, it sounds, you know, unusual. Why don't you give him a call? Why don't you give him a call? I called him up. I got a young woman at the desk, and I said, I'm looking to stay at your hotel for this weekend. And guess what? It was more than what he paid off season, but substantially less than what was quoted online. So I booked a room. And I scratched my head, and I hung up, and I said, I know how this works. You know, all of these aggregators are going to all the vendors and saying, like, just, you know, put off a block of rooms for the net. Put off this block of rooms, and, you know, you can charge whatever you want for it, and if you book it, we get a third, or we get a fifth, or a tenth, whatever it is. It's making supposedly making it easy for the consumer, but not necessarily less expensive. Everything is in Amazon on discount. And I thought about this, and I thought, this is so strange. Some idiot without a computer could have called on the phone and gotten a cheaper rate than me, who's going to book it online, doing all the work by myself. What's wrong with this picture? And in my mind, I'm saying, this is probably going on in small businesses around the world. It's just not kosher.
Well, but it's not kosher, and people, they'll give you good reasons for it. Have you written about Axion or any of those outfits?
No.
Axion is the aggregator of all data. They're the ones who put together all of your credit card receipts, all of the things you buy in a supermarket, all the tolls you go through, all the whatever.
Yeah.
And then they collect it and they sell it to people. The government can collect some information on you without a warrant. They can, however, buy from Axion the people who meet this criteria, and you can be one of them. An interesting thing just came out about last year. The University of Pittsburgh owns 7 or 8 hospitals in the Pittsburgh area. They also have an insurance company, and the insurance company works in predictive analysis about what people will need and everything. Then they have very extensive questionnaires. And do you fill out everything? Do you smoke? Do you drink? How much do you drink? How much television do you watch? Without telling you, they go to Axion and they compare. So if you've said that you don't drink, but they find out that you spend $500 a month at the liquor store, you could be buying for your alcoholic father-in-law, but they don't
right.
know that.
Exactly.
And all of this stuff, to me, that's unethical. To everyone else, it's just a way of doing business. You know,
yep.
At a minimum, they should tell you that we're validating your information from available online sources. You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's again, this is big data, and one of the reasons why big data doesn't always work is that one time for my summer house, I Googled low-cost heating oil, you know, number 2 heating oil, home heating oil, you know, I Googled that, right? So I you know, kind of responded to a bunch of local suppliers, okay? Guess what? The following week, I got a junk email from Sears saying, when did I want to book an appointment with one of their experts to find out what it would cost to replace my furnace? Okay? Yeah, that's the joke. I'm thinking, like, wait a minute. Now, before I laughed about it and said, this is pathetic, I said, they don't care. Because, you know, the stuff on the net, when you're buying it in bulk, it's so cheap, you just go ahead and buy it. And they say, well, this is only going to be a certain amount of targeting here and there and everything. They said, well, we don't care. If we get X amount of customers, that's great.
Absolutely.
Okay, but But exactly. So, but look at how your information is being handled. The good companies now are sensitive and say, we don't share, we don't sell, we don't do this, we don't do that. But I've seen a lot of mediums companies now. I've got one that said, hey, safe unsubscribe. I go through the unsubscribe. Tell us why you unsubscribe. It may take 2 weeks. 2 months later, I still get mail from them. What's wrong with this picture? And this is not just one isolated incident. It goes on and on and on. And I'm saying there are people like me that are probably going to get more annoyed than I am because I can just click trash. And they're thinking, like, why is this happening? I thought technology was so, efficient. And the thing that we're finding, and that's the crux of this part of the conversation, is that it's powerful but not necessarily efficient.
We have a two-year-old Hyundai, and we've gotten probably in the last month and a half things in the mail. Answer this immediately. This is your last chance. We know your warranty is running out. That leads you to try to make believe that they're Hyundai.
Yeah,
really
I know.
Some third-party garage someplace.
This type of thing is ubiquitous. I'm getting it now from my Toyota Prius as well. Yeah, same thing. It's frustrating, but, this is the reality. You've got to sift through a lot of chaff to get to the wheat.
We've talked about big data's come up. We talked about IBM before. Now, IBM, as you've been following us, has been trying to rebrand toward machine learning. And the interesting thing here is, if you follow this, that we're leaving the whole age of programming where humans gave instruction. Now we have humans giving goals, and it's up to the computer, as the computer that beat both Jeopardy and the computer that beat Go, to figure out how to do it. And it's a whole new ball game, and it's, are we losing control? I mean, IBM points out that they had that in one of the work that they did with Sloan Kettering, that they were analyzing women that risk of breast cancer, and they knew there were nine things that they should be looking for. And they went through this whole routine, and the computer came back and said, wrong. There are 12. They found three new indicators just from them figuring out, going through the data, comparing, and coming back. So in some way, that's marvelous. Now, for IBM to be able to market this and to change the whole business and to compete with the Googles who are doing it and with the Facebooks, we're in this high-powered clash of titans to what's going to happen, I think.
Well, I think IBM, there's two issues going on there. What IBM's good at, which you've just described, but I talked to a friend of mine who's the chief speechwriter for Ginni Cometti, and we're always talking about IBM, and he's read my book, and, yada, yada, yada. And I say, right now, image-wise, I said, if you ask somebody what IBM does well, they'll say Jeopardy and chess. So, but I know that's being unfair. On the other hand, big data analytics and their work in healthcare is going to be monumental at some point because, a lot of medical diagnoses is solving mysteries, which is what attracts bright minds to medicine. And, every case isn't always the same. It's not just a matter of going through tests and then taking a pill and hoping for the best and saying, here are your odds. And computers can do a lot of the scut work that doctors are doing more efficiently, quickly, and with greater accuracy. But John, will the patient, relationship with the doctor ever, will that replace it? No, it can't. It really can't, and it shouldn't. But here's the thing. If you talk to people in medicine now, they talk about HIPAA. They talk about paperwork and the third-party insurers. And, offices that used to have staffs of one or two, a biller and a doctor and a physician's assistant, now have offices of five or six. They have to have someone to just call up the insurer to find out if the person's covered. That's a full-time job. And I'm thinking, like, uh-oh. So everything gets complicated. And some of these computer printouts that come from the doctor's offices are very comprehensive and good, but they're only as good as the doctors and the physician's assistants that are inputting the data. That's basic computing 101, right? GIGO. So
because of the expense and the importance of doing this, we have Weill Cornell and Columbia Presbyterian merging to New York Presbyterian. Then we have New York Presbyterian has just taken over my local hospital, Hudson Valley Hospital.
Right.
My doctor and hundreds of thousands of doctors in Westchester area, they're now part of the Mount Kisco Medical Group that extends from Yonkers north to Poughkeepsie. So there's all these things coming together, both because of the cost of technology and the need to keep up with the regulations and with the billing and with all this stuff. Yeah. So it's changing. There isn't much room for the doctor running around in the Model T with the black bag anymore.
No, that issue is over. The younger doctors are sort of getting it. The older doctors have given up on the system. The younger doctors are in it now, not for the money, but for the thrill of being in medicine. And I see the pendulum swinging back. You know, my wife is a stroke survivor, as you may know, and she has a raft of doctors, and the two best doctors she has right now are her neurophysiologist and her cardiologist. Both of her are young women in their mid-30s. You know what? They answer email, they answer phone calls, they give a lot of time in the office. They're busy, but they make the time to be good doctors. The older doctors, they've given up fighting with the insurance companies. I've been in the offices where they turn red and start screaming. But, you know, and medicine didn't turn out the way they thought it would be when they first got their black bags and went into the hospital. So you got to hope that there's some hope there. Because I've seen every phase of good, mediocre, and bad medicine. And, you know, it's not going to change overnight. We have an aging population, and technology is keeping us alive longer and not necessarily with better quality of life. If you still have listeners out there and they're staying with us for this long, I really implore them to read Atul Gawande's book, which has been around for a while now, which is terrific, called Being Mortal. It's about geriatric medicine and the boomers getting older and, you know, what's in store in nursing homes and the changing face of medicine. And it's very touching because he talks about his father's late life crises in medicine as a patient until his death. So it's got a personal touch, but he does a lot of broad-based research, and it's a very wonderful book. It's got some upbeat moments, but this is the future. You know, where people want to live longer and go on longer. The question is, you know, as there's a wonderful little book that I just read that Michael Kinsley wrote. You know, Old Age: A Beginner's Guide.
He said it used to be
that the guy who died with the most toys won. Now this thing is the guy who wins, the guy who lives the longest and still has his marbles wins, you know. And
most
I thought about that. It's funny.
Most of my doctors, and I've got my GP, and I've got my orthopedist, and I have my disc guy, and I've got 12 of them all the time. They all, when I ask them, they're all, unlike the insurance companies, they're all for us, the single payer system, would that be?
Yeah.
Because, and they all say that they can work better with Medicare than with anybody. Now, if
you
you
know why they've made that's interesting and it's true, because and I wrote about this for Newsweek when Meg had a stroke in 2003, and it came out in 2004. It's about Medicare is much more efficient just in terms of the slicing of the dollar. You know, it's 20 to 30 cents on the dollar for administrative non-medical costs.
Right.
And Medicare is somewhere between like 7% and 8%, something like that. It's way lower. So you may not get the greatest doctors in the world, but you're going to get competent doctors. And a lot of these doctors are the ones that have said, I'll take the Medicare reimbursement because I can spend more time with the patients. I don't need to, you know, rush them in and out of the office to support a big practice and make a lot of money. These doctors are really good and should be kept around because they're still in it for practicing good medicine. And you know, in the old days, you would have said, "Oh, the Medicare reimbursement—it's worthwhile. You know, it's not so bad." Now, I look at some of these bills. I have doctor friends that complain about doctors' bills being outrageous. They say, like, "Oh my God, you know, the balance bill on this after my copay was ridiculous." I said, "Well, you're a doctor. Complain."
Yeah. Well, that's,
when the doctors start complaining about doctors, you know that that something's going on.
That's where the ARP and all that stuff helps out.
Yeah. Now,
my oldest friend, who you may have come across in the publishing industry, he is a stroke sufferer. Kevin Buckley, he was Newsweek's Vietnam correspondent during the war.
Oh wow!
But he was most recently a Playboy's editor in New York.
Right.
So, he had a stroke about 5 years ago, and he's had moderate recovery.
Yeah.
So what's next for you after all this?
Well, I call myself in semi-retirement. You know, I'm on some social, you know, it's funny. I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and Twitter. But mostly I'm on Facebook, and I look at the social media, and my son used to say, "Dad, Facebook is your father's social network." I say, no, Facebook is your grandfather's social network. So I don't know. I'm looking for my next book, something to really inspire me and have fun with, and not worry about the money. And I take care of my wife with a couple of aides, and you know, it's hard to just say I want to retire. And I guess, I don't have a structured day. I would really love to do one more book before I bow out. I think I have one more good book in me. I don't know what it's about or when. I've been taking a lot of notes on my wife's illness. I don't know if I'll ever publish anything, but it's the personal writing is more I'm more drawn to now. And I know why a lot of successful writers say, "I just want to get to that point where I say, give it to my agent and say, you can't change. Tell the publisher if they want it, great. They can't change a comma." You know, I don't have that kind of an ego, but on the other hand, I'm really starting to say, you don't have to write this if you don't really want to, you know, just for the money. I mean, you know, it's nice to be busy, but, you know, let's face it, the elderly population gets aged out when it comes to the workforce. And I'm not complaining about that. I'm just stating it as fact. When I was a young editor and I could hire the older guy for more money or the younger guy who wouldn't maybe be as good, but it was a lot cheaper. You know, I had a budget. I understood it. And so I don't knock it. You know, I was up for a job with Microsoft for a speechwriting job for one of the senior VPs. And I went to a couple of dog and pony shows. And, you know, they said, "You'll have to come out to Redmond." And I said, "No problem," and this and that. In the end, they went with somebody else local. And I said, "Smart idea. You know, I'm sure that person's going to be great."
Yeah.
You know, and you don't have to bring in the guy from New York, you know, to write a superstar speech here. You know, you probably have enough local talent to pull it off. You know, it's not magic. So I'm looking to do one more good book.
We've covered a lot of good ground tonight. What else might like the audience to know about Douglas Gore?
I don't know. You know, if I, you know, I Jerry Wexler, who famously worked with Ahmet Erdogan, and I got to know him late in life, and he died in his 90s. He produced a lot of great musicians in jazz and in rock and roll. And I asked him one day, you know, I was so impressed. I saw those gold records. We had been to his house for dinner parties. And I said, "Jerry, you know," "what do you want on your tombstone?" And he said, just two words. I said, "What's that?" He said, "More bass." And I laughed. you know, the guy had a great sense of humor. You know, life is this, life's a carnival, you know. You kind of flow through it. Don't take yourself too seriously here. So, you know, somebody asked me that same question. They said, you know, "Doug, what do you want on your tombstone when you die?" And I said, I don't know. I said, I hope my last words are something like, "If it's a slow news day, maybe somebody can get me a couple of inches in the Times." But other than that, you know, my wife's had a far more accomplished career than I have. And she would certainly deserve something like that. But, you know, it's really, you know, I'm looking to, you know, the biggest essay question in the world is mankind getting more intelligent collectively? And, you know, that's the, if I were the teacher and I'd say, this is your extra credit, write me 750 words, take either side, it doesn't matter which side you argue for, but just send me a cogent argument on 750 words. Are we getting more intelligent or not? And what is, you know, Carlo Rovelli, this physicist in the south of France, an Italian physicist, wrote a great book called The Seven Brief Lessons on Physics.
Yep.
And I still don't know anything more about gluons and quantum mechanics and, you know, relativity than I did when I read the book. It's only about 80 pages. But I loved it. It just had such a nice flow. The guy understood language, John. And I recommend it because at the end, you know, this guy's not a wingnut. And at the end, he just said, the turtle is going to last longer than a human being. And this was his logic. He said, the turtle has not evolved in hundreds and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of years. The turtle is the turtle. Think about that. He said, mankind has gone through incredible evolution. He said, I think mankind's doomed. And this is before he got into stuff, stupid stuff like climate change, you know, and war and nuclear this and that. He basically said, up against the turtle, we're nothing. And I looked at that and I read it, and it was written so lyrically and beautifully that to argue against it, you would have to be a very smart person. That's what I'd like to leave you with.
See, I thought the question, it goes back to one that I heard about 50 years ago. What's it all about, Alfie?
There you go. There you go. I mean, and think about it. When I tell people, they say, when people look at me askance with that, I say, I'll leave you with one thought. The dinosaurs ruled the Earth for 150 million years. Man has been around for 15,000, give or take. Who's got a better track record?
Yep.
There you go, guy. You've heard the philosophy from A to B and back again from Doug Gar. I don't know. I hope it entertained somebody out there.
Thank you very much, Doug. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, listen, anytime you want to talk, you know, just give me a ring. And I'm flattered to have been asked on your show.
A bit of commercial information. My column now appears biweekly in West of the Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. West of the Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westoftheguardian.com. My books are available on Amazon, and I blog at medium.com. Send any comments to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Until next week, when I'll be back with author Virginia Heffernan, and I hope you'll join us then. Until then, as used to say, the old neighbor, see you. And steady, Silver, steady, steady, Silver. Thanks again, Doug.
It was my pleasure. I really appreciated it. I hope you didn't mind going overtime.
No, absolutely not.
Well, great.